We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is a real pleasure for me to welcome back to the program former columnist for The Independent. Has written for The Nation magazine, The New York Times, The LA Times, and award winner on his new book, Chasing the Scream, The First and Last Days of the War on Drugs. Yohan Hari, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Sam. It's great to be with you. This is the first interview I've done about my book where I have not drunk any caffeine. So I'm going to try and be ironically drug-free for this entire interview.
Well, good luck with that. I am on my third
if I
cup.
I lapsed into a coma, that's the reason why.
All right. Well, hopefully you'll stick with us. Maybe my caffeine level will help. And I got to say, you know, look, and my audience knows this. I have two kids now. I have very little time. Generally, you know, I don't get through books that I read. I did not get through this, but I did end up staying up until about 1 a.m. And read almost most of it now.
It is an
incredibly compelling book. It's very well done. On this program, we've talked to people about the drug war. We interviewed Carl Hart, among others, you've woven together here composites of and stories of people, both historical and recent history and contemporaneous, that I think is just wonderful. So I wanted to just start by telling you that. Congratulations.
Thanks, Dan. That really means a lot to me coming from you. Thank you.
So let's start. Let's start with Harry Aidsinger. He is a character that I don't think that Americans are terribly aware of. I love the story of this guy to the extent that it also talks about what happens to a bureaucracy when its central mission is lost. Because in some ways, there may be another Harry Aidsinger in, I don't know, 5, 10, 15 years in this country, whoever the head of the DEA is at that time. But tell us who he was.
Well, I guess just to step back for a second, it's now 100 years since drugs were first criminalized in the United States. And as that centenary was coming up, I had a quite personal reason to want to look into this. We'd had addiction in my family. One of my first memories was of trying to wake up one of my relatives and not being able to. And as I got older, realizing we had cocaine addiction in my family. And I realized there were lots of questions that I didn't know the answer to, which is like, why were drugs banned in the first place? Why do we carry on with this war on drugs, even though it doesn't seem to be working? What really causes drug use and drug addiction, and what are the alternatives? And one of the things that was so striking to me is so many of the answers come back to this man, Harry Anslinger. Harry Anslinger is, I think, the most influential person no one's ever heard of. Every one of your listeners, one way or another, has had their lives influenced by this man. Harry Anslinger was a genius government bureaucrat. He took over the Department of Prohibition just as alcohol prohibition is ending. And so he's got this really big government department with a very demoralized and corrupt workforce because they've just been fighting the war on alcohol and they lost. And he wants to find it a purpose. And he latches on to drugs. And he becomes obsessed with this. And Harry Anslinger really has two guiding hatreds in his life. One is a real hatred of addicts based on a bad experience he had as a little boy with one of his neighbors. And the other is a really deep hatred of African Americans. He's the racist who racists at the time thought went too far. He used the N-word in official government memos. It was so extreme that his own senator called him to resign. But the way I enter his story in the book is through, I went to his archives and I tracked down lots of people, is through his obsession with Billie Holiday. In 1939, Billie Holiday stands on stage in New York City and she sings Strange Fruit, a beautiful anti-lynching song. And according to her biographer, Julia Blackburn, that night, the Federal Bureau of Narcotics tell her to stop and she refuses to. And that's when they begin stalking her and the process that eventually led to her death begins, in which I believe, and I think I show in the book, the Federal Bureau of Narcotics was complicit. And to me, this story is so important because it tells us both where the drug war came from and what's driving it now. When you think about it, if you'd said to me a few years ago, why did the drug war start? I would have guessed that it would have started for the reasons we would give now, which would be, you know, we don't want people to become addicted, we don't want kids to use drugs. that barely comes up. Really, the driving obsession that starts the drug war is the belief that black people and Chinese people are taking drugs, forgetting their place, and attacking white people. They turned the war on drugs when other attempts to keep African-Americans and Chinese-Americans down have failed. And Billie Holiday is the ultimate symbol of this. This is as her goddaughter Lorraine Feather said to me, to have an African-American woman standing in front of a white, largely white audience in a hotel where she wasn't even allowed to walk through the front door. She had to go through the service elevator and sing a song against lynching. That was so shocking at the time. That was everything Harry Anslinger hated. And the story of what he did to her next, I think, symbolizes what's been done to so many addicts all across the world, partly because of Anslinger's work. The first guy he sends to stalk her is a guy called Jimmy Fletcher. Harry Anslinger hated employing black people, but you couldn't really send a white guy into Harlem to stalk Billie Holiday. It'd be kind of conspicuous. So he employs this guy called Jimmy Fletcher, and Jimmy Fletcher follows her for 2 years. He dances with her, goes to all these parties, he sees her. And she was such an amazing person that Jimmy Fletcher fell in love with her. And all his life he felt ashamed of what he did. He busts her. She said about the trial, it was called the United States versus Billie Holiday, and that's how it felt. She's put on trial. She's sent to prison. She doesn't sing a word in prison. She comes out and she can't perform anymore, because to get a cabaret performer's license, which you needed to be able to sing anywhere where alcohol was served, you couldn't have a criminal record. Her friend Yolanda Bavan said to me, "What is the cruelest thing you can do to a person is to take away their talent." And Billie Holiday is in this terrible state. Anslinger's not finished with her. He sends another guy to stalk her, a guy called George White, who boasts that he's going to kick her down the stairs. George White, we now know, was himself a drug user. In fact, drugged women in order to sexually assault them. Eventually, in her early 40s, Billie Holiday collapses. She's got liver cancer. They take her to hospital. The hospital turns her away because she's an addict. They take her to another hospital. And in that hospital, that Anslinger's men have her arrested on her deathbed. They handcuff her to the bed. I spoke to the last surviving person who was in that room, an amazing man called Eugene Callender. Billie Holiday says to one of her friends, "They're going to kill me in there. Don't let them kill me." She goes into withdrawal because obviously she hasn't got any heroin there. And one of her friends, Maylie Duffy, insists they give her methadone. She starts to recover. 10 days later, they cut off the methadone and she died. One of her friends said to the BBC she looked like she had been violently wrenched from life. And to me, the story of what happened to Billie Holiday, it's both symbolic of what's happening now. Your listeners know very well the racial disparity and how the drug laws are enforced, and we can talk a bit about that if you like. But also, I think the heroism of it. When Billie Holiday was a little girl growing up in Baltimore, and she wasn't allowed in the stores for white people, she promised herself she would never bow her head to any white man. And what the thing that was amazing to me about Billie Holiday is she never stopped singing that song. Even when they did all that to her, she went anywhere she could to sing her anti-lynching song. And she was heroic. And it kind of helped me when I was looking at my own addicted relatives. And, anyone who's ever loved an addict gets angry sometimes. I could see the heroism that Billie Holiday had and lots of other people I met on my journey. I ended up traveling 30,000 miles across 8 different countries. And I could see some of that in them, the heroism of surviving when you're in agony.
Indeed. I mean, it's an amazing, I guess, a metaphor. And also, again, the idea of how drugs have been used. And then I want to also turn and just touch on this this aspect of the story that I guess runs sort of parallel or even prior to it is the story of Arnold Rothstein, because and how you weave in Arnold Rothstein with Chino Hardin.
Chino. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, tell us about that, because it's a fascinating sort of, beginning to the drug war, and hopefully, one aspect that maybe marks towards the end.
Well, one thing that's really striking is, and this is something I hadn't really thought about until I started doing the research. Drugs used to be legal. The way it worked is you would go to your local pharmacy and you would buy your drugs. The most popular way of consuming opiates was something called a Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup, which contained opiates. And one of the things that's fascinating is when drugs are banned, you can really see the effect of criminalizing drugs when the ban comes in. So the first thing that happens is a massive army of drug dealers is created who previously did not exist. And those drug dealers fight and kill each other, you know, to control their patch. Arnold Rothstein is the greatest example. He was the defining and iconic gangster of the jazz age. There's an incredible book that his wife wrote, which is one of the main sources for my understanding who this man was. Arnold Rothstein is this infinitely complex and dark figure, but he really invents modern drug dealing. And we can understand a lot from him. If you think about, you know, the alcohol aisle at Walmart does not go and blow up the alcohol aisle at CVS, right? Right. Why? Because if you go and try to steal their alcohol, they can call the police and the police will come and deal with you. Now, if you're a weed dealer or a coke dealer, obviously if someone tries to steal your product, you can't call the police. They'll arrest you if you do that. So you have to fight back. But more importantly, you have to establish a reputation for being so terrifying that no one will dare to fight back. And that, there's a sociologist called Philippe Bourgeois who talks about how the war on drugs creates a culture of terror where dealers have to be terrifying. Arnold Rothstein is the perfect first example of this. You know, this is a man who the cops were scared of Arnold Rothstein. And what fascinated me, as I wanted to go about, I'd say about the first quarter of the book is about the early drug war and then the rest is about today. Arnold Rothstein died a few blocks away from where one of the most amazing people I know was born. Chino Hardin is a transsexual former crack dealer from Brownsville, Brooklyn, who's, I think, a year younger than me. I'm 36. And Chino was conceived when his mother, Deborah, who was a crack addict, was raped by his father, Victor, who was an NYPD officer. He is a child of the drug war in the truest sense. Deborah died in the first wave of the AIDS epidemic because nothing was done to protect people. In fact, people who tried to hand out needles were criminalized for drug paraphernalia. And Chino started selling crack when he was 13. He was at that time kind of biologically a woman. And Chino rose through the Crips, became quite a senior member of the Crips, was in and out of first a horrendous youth prison called Spafford and then Rikers. And there's a complex and extraordinary story about what happened to Chino. But when Chino was in his early 20s and he got out of prison the last time, Chino basically started learning about the drug war and had this incredible epiphany where he realized, oh my God, this didn't have to happen. I didn't have to be born in such awful circumstances. My mother didn't have to die. I didn't have to go into this world of extreme violence created by the drug war. He became one of the most articulate opponents of the drug war that I know. And he then led a campaign to shut down Spafford, the youth prison that he was put in, and succeeded. That Spafford no longer exists. And one of the things I was looking for all the way through the writing of this book is, I think part of the problem with the way we've discussed the drug war is we talk in big and grand abstractions. We talk about, you know, should they, you know, big, bold, philosophical conversations. And what I wanted to do with this book is talk about real people. I wanted to sit with people whose lives had been changed by the war on drugs and listen to them and tell the story of what their everyday life is like. And that went from a huge range of people, from someone like Chino to the only person to ever make it out of one of the worst Mexican drug cartel and live to tell what they're like on right. The inside, to, you know, a scientist who spends a lot of time feeding hallucinogens to mongooses to see what happens, to the only country that's ever decriminalized all drugs. I wanted to, you know, Chino was someone I went back to over 3 years. I got to know Chino so well, and I really wanted people who read Chasing the Scream to get a sense of what this war does to real people on the ground every day and what the alternatives can be like.
Yeah, I want to, you know, I mean, there is so much ground to cover here, and obviously we're not going to cover it all in this interview. But, you know, as you were talking about, just going back to when you were talking about Arnold Rothstein, you also traveled down to Juarez and that element of just how vicious drug dealers have to be as almost like best practices for their business. I mean, honestly, I mean, I hate to put it that way, but I mean, we hear these stories of these Mexican cartels doing the most heinous acts ones that might make ISIS blush.
You're totally right. And one of the things I learned most, one of the most fascinating people, and actually I've surprised people who read the book and said, the person I think I felt most sorry for of all the hundreds of people I met was a guy called Rosalio Retta, right, who grew up in Laredo, which is obviously on the border with Nuevo Laredo, with on the Texan side of the border. And at that time, you know, kids would just kind of go back and forth across the border a lot, you know, because candies and things were cheaper on the Mexican side. At the age of 13, Rosalio was recruited to be a hitman for the Zetas. And it's a really interesting story about how the Zetas came to being, I can tell in a minute. Do you want me to say that? The Zetas, this is great news for American taxpayers if you're wondering where your money went. In the early 21st century, the American government decided to train an elite anti-drug squad for the Mexicans to kind of be a SAS or... Green Berets for the Mexican drug war. And so they spent, I think it was $500 million. They take them to, I think, Fort Bragg. Huge amount of military spending, huge amount of weapons. And they go back to Mexico and a month later defect en masse to set up a cartel. So the Zetas are people that you set up. Rosalio joins them, and Rosalio is then kind of set off into the, and I tell his story in full, but he's then set off to commit unimaginable atrocities. But one of the things that's really important to understand when we look at the Mexican story, it can sound just like the kind of Saw movies almost. It can sound just like deranged sadism. It's unimaginably awful, but it's really important to understand it's perfectly logical within the system we've created. Right. If you think about it as a culture of terror, you want to be the dealer who no one will mess with, right? So every time you're prepared to go a little bit further than the other guy, you gain a brief competitive advantage. So if you're the guy who says, let's kill the other side's pregnant women, you get a brief competitive advantage. If you're the guy who says, let's kill their pregnant women and put it on YouTube, then you get a brief competitive advantage. If you're the guy who says, well, let's kill the other side, cut off their faces, sew it to a football, and post the football to their family, this is a real example, then you get a brief competitive advantage. And it's really important to understand how that works. And one of the ways I explain it in the book is, you know, it really struck me in Juarez. I had a fantastic guide there, a guy called Julian Cardona, who is the Reuters correspondent there. And I remember he kept introducing me to people who'd been killed by the police. And I kept saying, oh, you know, this is before I'd met Rosalio. I said, you know, Julian, you've got to introduce me to people. This is important, but I need to meet people who've been killed by the cartels. And he just laughed and said, you don't understand, Johan. When the cartels want to kill people now, they just pay the police to do it.
Right. The police end up just being the errand boys, the paid killers of the cartels. And yeah, we should say that, you know, when you talk about, this idea of getting a competitive advantage, you know, growing up, the idea of these Colombia cartels, drug cartels, as being vicious, they now look like child's play relative to what's going on in Mexico.
It's a Darwinian process. So Al Capone would have been killed in 5 minutes by Pablo Escobar, and Pablo Escobar would be killed in 5 minutes by the Zetas. It's a Darwinian process where, you know, you're honing the violence every time. It's like a virus getting stronger and stronger over the years.
All right. So just tell us that story about Rosalio Retta. I mean, you said that you feel, I mean, this is a guy who...
Rosalio, yeah. I mean, Rosalio is now in prison in Tyler County in Texas, where I met him. And, you know, he spends all day, every day in solitary confinement. He will for the rest of his life, because every time they let him out, he gets immediately stabbed by someone because they know that their family will get a fortune. These guys are for life anyway. They know their families will get a fortune if they're the person who killed the only guy from the Zetas who ever spoke. He killed 70 people between the ages of 13 and 17. But I have to say, I feel desperately sorry for him. You know, he is the product. Clearly, he should be kept away from people, and clearly, he's not a safe person to have on the streets. But, you know, we created the system. Right. We created the Zetas. We created the logic of the system that he then became part of as a child soldier. And I feel desperately sorry for him.
I mean, it's interesting because you also, you know, discuss the idea that, you know, they're not as sadistic as they sound. They're not interested in sadists. They just want people who are good businessmen. And in this business, it's the functional equivalent of putting up a bigger sign or having.
Exactly. And this has nothing to do. That's a really smart way of putting it. And this has nothing to do with the drugs, right? If we prohibited milk, if you prohibit anything that's popular, it will get through. We can't keep drugs out of prisons, supermax prisons, and we've got a walled perimeter and guards manning it all the time. drugs will get into your country and my country, right? The question is, do we want them to be controlled by armed criminal gangs who create a culture of terror, or do we want them to be controlled by doctors and pharmacists? And I went to countries where they're controlled by doctors and pharmacists, and they're very different, and I can assure you there's no one like Rosalio Retta there.
Well, let's talk about, I mean, because, and, you know, I should also say that you spent a lot of time with police officers and former police officers who some of whom had very personal reasons to get involved in the drug war and have come out the other side saying, this is a joke. It's not working the same way. In fact, I want to touch on this because I was going to leap ahead to sort of the more polemical aspects or some of the polemical aspects of the reasons why people line up against the war on drugs. But before we get there, talk about Lee Maddox, because if I recall correctly, she is one of those instances of an individual who got involved for very personal reasons the drug. But she also had some great observations about what happens when you bust a drug leader.
Exactly. Lee is an amazing person. She always reminded me of them. Do you remember the Heather Locklear series at T.J. Hooker? Do you remember that? She always reminds me. For some reason, when I picture Lee, she's in my head as T.J. Hooker. Lee was a really tough, passionate believer in the war on drugs. She was a cop in Maryland. She signed up because one of her best friends was killed by a gang she believed was a drug gang. She could not have been more motivated to go after drug gangs. And Lee noticed something really interesting. If you as a cop bust a rapist, the next week there's less rape in your town, right? But if you bust a drug dealer, she noticed that two things happen. Firstly, there's no less drug dealing. Like everyone knows, the next morning someone else is on the corner. But interestingly, she noticed that the murder rate actually went up. It didn't go down, it went up. And she then kind of realized, well, it's because you trigger a turf war. If on Chino's patch in Brownsville, if you had just killed Chino or when he was taken off to prison, what happens? Well, Chino had previously controlled it, had established a culture of terror, had established a reputation, you don't screw with me. When he's gone, rival gangs fight for the control of it. This is what happens. Now, there is a way to deal with drug dealing, and it's to bankrupt them by transferring it to armed criminals, by transferring it to doctors and pharmacists. And we can talk about the different modes of regulation if you like. But yeah, some of the most passionate opponents of the drug war that I met were cops. Who really have been true believers, and anyone who really wants to get involved in this, I'd really recommend going to the website for Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, who are fantastic people.
Yeah, let's talk about it, because you mentioned that there has been this notion about drug addiction, and to sort of move into the other element of the book. I mean, sort of break it down into, the scientists who have been studying addiction are also part of this war on drugs, but almost sort of like peripherally in some respects. But they're in some ways they provide the answer. But you talk about how there's, you know, on the left we perceive drug addiction as where drug addicts are victimized by the chemical attraction to drugs. And on the right, they see it as drug addiction is a moral failing, but that there's really another reality when looking at drugs.
Exactly. This is the thing that most blew my mind when I was looking at this whole question. If you had said to me 4 years ago, what causes drug addiction? I would have looked at you like you were a little bit stupid, and I would have said drugs, right? And we have a story in our culture, which has been there for 100 years now, about what causes addiction that's really simple and has become part of our common sense. And it's basically, if you, me, and the next 20 people who walk past your window in Brooklyn, if we all used heroin for 20 days, on day 21, we'd all be heroin addicts because there are chemical hooks in the heroin that our body, by day 21, would physically need, right? That's what we believe addiction is. One of the first things that was explained to me by a brilliant guy called Gabor Mate, a doctor in Vancouver, that kind of threw me off, was he explained that, okay, so if you, Sam, step out of your studio today and, God forbid, you get hit by a car and you break your hip, you'll be taken to hospital and you'll be given a huge amount of diamorphine. Diamorphine is heroin. It's actually much better heroin than you'd score on the streets because it's medically pure, whereas the stuff you buy from a dealer would only be 5% purity as opposed to 100%. you'll be given that diamorphine for quite a long time. That's happening in every hospital in America, every hospital in Britain, every hospital in Europe, everywhere, right? Completely standard. If what we believed about addiction was right, those people should leave hospital and need the drug, right? They should, if the chemical hooks are what get them, they should be addicts. That virtually never happens. And that's when I think, oh, how could this be? And then I looked into an amazing man called Bruce Alexander, who's a professor in Vancouver, talked me through this extraordinary experiment that he did. The old theory of addiction, the one that we all implicitly believe, comes from a series of experiments that were done earlier in the 20th century, and they're really simple. You could do them at home if you were feeling particularly sadistic. You get a rat, you put it right in a cage, and it's got two water bottles. One is just tap water, and one is water laced with either heroin or cocaine. If you do that, the rat will always prefer the drugged water and will almost always kill itself quite quickly. You might remember the Partnership for Drug-Free America advert.
Yes, when I read that, I have vivid memories of that rat ad.
Exactly. And we think, well, there you go, that's addiction. Bruce came along in the 70s and he said, well, hang on a minute. We're putting the rat in an empty cage. It's got nothing to do. Let's try this differently. So Bruce built Rat Park, which is like heaven for rats, right? It's like everything your rat about town could want is in Rat Park. It's got loads of friends. It's got loads of nice food. It's got loads of colored balls. It's got everything a rat wants. And it's got both the water bottles. It's got the tap water and the drugged water. Obviously, all the rats try both the water bottles because they don't know what's in them. But here's the thing. In Rat Park, they don't like the drugged water. None of them ever overdose, and they don't use in a compulsive way that looks like addiction. This is kind of mind-blowing. You've gone from almost all of them killing themselves to none of them ever killing themselves. And what Bruce says is, this is really important because it tells us that both the left and right-wing theories are wrong. It's not about, it's not, your brain isn't hijacked, it's not a disease, it's not about your moral failings, it's not about you being flawed. It's your environment, it's your cage. And Bruce has shown in a lot of detail, and discussed this in the book, how that applies to human beings. There's actually an experiment that was running at the very same time as Rat Park, a human equivalent. It's called the Vietnam War. Around 20% of American soldiers in Vietnam were using heroin regularly. And if you read the news reports from the time, they were really worried. They were like, my God, we're going to have hundreds of thousands of junkies on the streets of the United States. You know, big stories. You had senators going out there really worried about this. Actually, what happened? All the evidence shows they came home and just stopped. Because if you take them out of the equivalent of the first cage, a hellish, pestilential jungle where you could be killed at any moment, you don't want to be there, it's a nightmare, and you go back to your nice home in Wichita, Kansas, where you've got your friends and your connections and your family, you don't want to be on smack all the time. And I think this requires us to really fundamentally change how we think about addiction. The opposite of addiction is not sobriety. The opposite of addiction is connection. And we've created a culture where a lot of us are really disconnected from each other and from sources of meaning. And if we want to really deal with addiction, we have to deal with that. And in case that sounds abstract, I went to a country where they've acted on this, Portugal, and we can perhaps talk a little bit about that.
Yes, indeed. I want to talk about Portugal. I also want to make sure that we touch on Vancouver just a little bit. But let's talk about Portugal, because this has basically been a real world experiment that is now nearly 15 years old. So tell us what you found there.
It was so fascinating. 15 years ago, Portugal had one of the worst drug problems in Europe. 1% of the population was addicted to heroin, which is mind-blowing. And what the main political, they tried the American way, they tried cracking down harder and harder, and every year they cracked down, things got worse, which might sound familiar to some of your readers, some of your listeners, rather. And so what the leaders of the main political parties did is they got together and they said, look, let's set up a panel of scientists and doctors, and let's all agree in advance that whatever they recommend, they'll do. I don't think they thought the panel would recommend something so radical, but the panel came back and said, decriminalize everything, from cannabis to crack, and crucially, this is the really crucial bit, transfer all the money that we currently spend on arresting drug users, trying drug users, imprisoning drug users, take all that money and spend it on something completely different. Let's spend it on radically reconnecting drug addicts with the society. So partly that's rehab, which is useful, and emotional support. But it was fascinating on the ground seeing this. A lot of it is things like subsidized jobs. So say you were a mechanic, you know, you became an addict. What they'll do is they'll say to an employer, you know, if you employ this guy as a mechanic, we'll pay half the wages for a year. And what that's all about is saying, it's the opposite of the drug war logic. The drug war logic is punish the addict, cut him off. You know, I mean, I literally went to prisons in Arizona where I saw women are put in a hole and made to go out on chain gangs who'll never be able to get jobs again. We take an addict who's an addict because they're disconnected and make it impossible for them to reconnect or extremely difficult. Portugal is the exact opposite. It's about giving people something to get out of bed for in the morning who are addicts. And what's fascinating about this process is it's now nearly 15 years on, and the results are in, and they're pretty striking. One thing we have to be candid about is drug use very slightly went up by around 5 or 6%. But crucially, addiction has fallen dramatically. Every study shows that. Injecting drug use has fallen by 50%, 50%. Overdose is massively down. HIV transmission is massively down. And one of the ways you know it's a success is that no one wants to go back. One of the most moving interviews I did was with a guy called João Figueira, who is the top drug cop in Portugal. And he was the leader of the opposition to the decriminalization. And he said a lot of the things that some of your readers, listeners, some of your listeners will totally reasonably be thinking now, which is he said, you know, surely if we decriminalize drugs and stop punishing anyone for ever doing it, you know, we'll have drug use run rampant, we'll have, you know, drug tourism, all those things. And what he said to me, I'm paraphrasing, the exact words are in the book, but he said, you know, everything I said would happen didn't happen. And everything the other side said would happen did happen. And he talked to me about how not only did he hope the whole world follows Portugal's example, but he really regretted that he'd spent 20 years arresting and harassing drug users, and he could see how futile that was. Mm. You know, it's one thing that really struck me. I went to three countries that have moved beyond the drug war, Uruguay, Portugal, and Switzerland, and none of those countries regretted it. You know, no one who goes beyond the drug war regrets it. And the thing is, it's been 100 years. One thing we can definitely say about drug prohibition, we gave it a fair shot.
Right.
No one can say we didn't do our best.
Right.
And we've got to compare the results with the real world.
And I will say, too, that you also make it clear that it's not simply the argument here in terms of drugs. I mean, you talk about you write about the scientific research that is involved in why animals, including humans, take drugs, and that it's not simply that a prohibition is worse of an answer than decriminalization or legalization.
This was another thing that surprised me, actually, to realize that, first of all, 90% of all drug use is non-problematic. Those aren't the figures from the legalization body. Those are the figures from the main drug war body in the world, the United Nations Office of Drug Control, which is really striking. 90% of all drug use doesn't harm anyone. And that's kind of counter to how we're taught by the drug. If I said to you, picture an alcohol user, you would picture someone drinking quite happily in a bar. If I said to you, picture a cocaine user, you would picture someone out of control, I'm guessing. Actually, the cocaine user is less likely to be out of control than the alcohol user, proportionate to the number of people who use that drug. But it's not how we picture it, because obviously the drug war drives that drug use underground. But some of the funniest stuff I got for the book, actually, was there's a guy called Professor Ronald K. Siegel from LA, who is a professor at UCLA, retired now, advisor to many American presidents. And he spent a lot of time giving drugs to animals to see what happens. And it turns out elephants love getting drunk and smashing stuff up. And but he talks about how this is really a universal natural desire, the desire to get intoxicated. There are very few animal species and no humans who do not have a desire to get intoxicated in some way. If you live in an environment where there are no natural intoxicants like the poor Inuit, you starve yourself in order to get out your head, because it's such a deep human impulse to seek altered states of mind. And the vast majority of the time, that altered state of mind does no one any harm. The circumstances in which it does harm are not caused by the drugs themselves. You can use drugs quite heavily and not become addicted. It's if you're in terrible pain, you're isolated, you're disconnected. That's when it goes wrong. It's not the quantity of drug use. And that was kind of hard, partly because of my family background. That was kind of hard for me to get my head around for a while, but the evidence is really strong.
You know, what's also fascinating, I mean, just moving on to sort of like, you know, where we could go from this is that, and you know, we have talked on this program about, you know, issues of poverty and how many times the solution, you know, there's a very strange relationship, particularly in this country, I imagine also in the UK to a certain extent, but where poverty is attempted to be addressed by education, when in fact it is poverty that really impacts educational outcomes. And there's a poverty functions in that way, I think, for a lot of issues. And in some ways, it functions in that way in this issue. In other words, if we decriminalized or legalized, actually get in, and we should talk a little bit about the way that some of these regulatory structures happen. And we obviously have two states in this country now where we're starting to see, you know, very early experiments with this on some level. But the biggest danger, it seems to me, in, or at least that could be argued, in decriminalization or legalization of drugs in this country is in those areas where there are, where there is abject poverty, where there is really no genuine hope to be connected to the rest of society in terms of having the same opportunities in some level. But it is also just a way of continually to ignore the phenomena of poverty. In other words, you know, you could say decriminalization is a problem for areas like maybe Camden, New Jersey, for instance, but simultaneously, really, the problem is just the poverty. The problem's already there, in other words.
I think that's really important, and I think there's a lot in what you say. Bruce Alexander, the guy who designed the Rat Park experiment and carried it out, talks about how in addiction we talk all the time about individual recovery and that has some value. But he said we need to talk much more about social recovery. It's actually something's gone wrong with us as a group rather than just something going wrong with us as individuals. And I think you're totally right. What I would say about, I actually went to Camden, New Jersey for the book along with lots of other, the kind of poorest parts of the United States. And what I would say about those places is, you know, drugs could not be more freely available than they are in Camden, New Jersey. And it would be literally impossible for them to be more freely available. They're on the corner. And actually, it goes to what you were saying about regulation. What we have at the moment is a system of anarchy, right? Unknown criminals selling unknown chemicals to unknown users. Legalization is a way of restoring order and regulation to the currently anarchic system and reclaiming it from kind of chaos, really. And obviously, it's important for people to understand, legalization of drugs doesn't mean every drug will be available to everyone all the time. In fact, quite the opposite. No one wants there to be a crack aisle in CVS. What we have at the moment is already the systems of regulation that we need, covering things like alcohol and prescription drugs. If you think about alcohol, the system of regulation that we currently have for alcohol is something that I would expand to include cannabis. The system of regulation we currently have for lots of other powerful drugs that are given out by doctors is something that I would expand to cover something like heroin. So something like ecstasy, you might have regulated bars or clubs that could sell it. The crucial thing there is that's about reclaiming it. And also, we'll get $41 billion a year is the estimate from Professor Jeffrey Myron about the amount that we would A, save in law enforcement, and then B, gain in taxation. You can do a hell of a lot with $41 billion. If I remember rightly, to send the figure is in the book, to send Chino and his four gangmates to Rikers cost $1 million a year. Mm. Is there anyone listening to this program who can't think of something better we could have done in Brownsville, Brooklyn, with $1 million a year than send those five kids to be in dingy concrete cells in Rikers Island? You know, we regain an enormous amount of money that we can use to deal with exactly the problems you're talking about. I mean, imagine what you could do with $41 billion a year that currently we may as well just be putting into a big pile and setting fire to or using it to light our crack pipes with.
Right. And, you know, I mean, the only, you know, as I contemplate that, you know, I had just seen a report, maybe it was on 60 Minutes, about a former housewife who started a basically growing cannabis company. Maybe it was in Colorado. And, you know, when you start getting into other drugs, I imagine that ends up being another sort of industry for big pharma, although I'm not sure exactly how that works. But I'm reminded there was one part in the book where you had raised that question of the oxycodone problems that we're having in this country, which address that. Because, I mean, how is that reconciled?
Well, this is really important. So what happens in Switzerland where I went with heroin, if you're a heroin addict, you go to your doctor and you say, doctor, I'm a heroin addict. They'll obviously test that it's true. They will assign you to a clinic where you will be given heroin for as long as you want it. In practice, most people, when they're stabilized on it and they don't have to buy it from criminals, decide to cut down their dose over time and eventually stop. That happens with almost everyone. Now, what you do with OxyContin, because sometimes you get people say, well, OxyContin's legal in America and look at what a disaster it's caused. And that sounds logical at first. Actually, what you do with Oxy and other opiate-based painkillers is exactly the opposite. If you go to your doctor and you say, doctor, I've got terrible back pain, then you might be given Oxy. If the doctor at any point suspects you're an addict, by law, they have to cut you off. And a lot of the problems, and they do, or they can be faced criminal charges themselves. Mm. And if you think about the problems that we associate with Oxy, where you get people holding up pharmacies and, you know, prostituting themselves and doing awful things, they don't come when they're given the Oxy. They come when they're cut off from the Oxy because they're addicts. And that's really important. Now, I'm not for a minute diminishing the fact that if you are using a lot of OxyContin, that contains within it dangers, and you will have a depleted life, and you should be given love and support to stabilize your life and cut back over time. But nothing gets easier by cutting them off and handing them over to criminal gangs. So there's partly that. There's another thing that's really interesting about Oxy. And to understand it, you have to understand a weird thing about the war on drugs. It's something called prohibition generally. It's called the iron law of prohibition. It's really simple. The day before alcohol was banned in America, a guy called Mike Gray explains this very well. The day before alcohol was banned in America, the most popular alcoholic drink by far was beer, right? Immediately after alcohol prohibition has ended, beer disappears and you can only get whiskey, right? And you think, well, why would that be? Why would banning a drug, why would banning alcohol change what people drank? It's really simple. If you have to smuggle something across the country, imagine that you and me were smuggling alcohol in a wagon, right? If we fill it with beer, we can only get 100 people there drink that night. If we fill it with whiskey, we can get 1,000 people right there drink that night. So what happens when you ban something is only the most extreme forms of the drug become available. This has happened with cannabis. You get people saying the cannabis that's smoked now is not the cannabis that people smoked in the 60s. They're damn right. It's the iron law of prohibition. You ban something, you crack down on it, only the most extreme forms will become available. And that dynamic is playing out with Oxy in a really interesting way. Most people who are Oxy addicts want to buy OxyContin, but it's really hard to buy it on the streets. What you can buy very cheaply is the much more potent opiate, heroin. I spoke to a very interesting guy in Oklahoma, Dr. Hal Vorse, who explained to me, you know, he's got patients who want OxyContin, go out on the streets and can't get it. So the next best thing for them is heroin, even though they don't want heroin. It's much more powerful. They'd rather have heroin than nothing. So one of the things that happens when you provide legal routes is people much prefer milder forms of the drug. Think about what we talked about earlier, Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup. Before opiates were banned, the most popular way of consuming them was a syrup. The most popular way of consuming cocaine was through tea. Who has even heard of cocaine tea now? No one, because it doesn't exist because of the iron law prohibition. My Gray talks about how there's a good way you can actually test the iron law prohibition. Just go to a college ball game, right? The college ball game, alcohol isn't allowed in, so it's a zone of prohibition, alcohol prohibition, right? We all know college students like beer, but what do they smuggle into the ball game?
Right.
They smuggle in whiskey.
Right, exactly.
Because it's less bulky and you can get it in. That's just the iron law prohibition playing out on a little scale.
That's fascinating. That narrative, and I've certainly heard that what's going on with people getting cut off from OxyContin and Vicodin and whatnot, and then turning to heroin, and so presumably, what is driving to the extent? I mean, does that not cut against? I mean, how does that explain that those addictions that take place with oxycodone? I mean, where does that
I think it's really important to relate it back to what you said earlier about Rat Park. You know, why are we seeing an addiction spike now? If you look through history, addiction spikes happen when you have people losing their sources of meaning and being profoundly disorientated. In the 18th century in Britain, you have the gin craze, and gin is presented as this demon drug, the crack of its day, because, you know, huge numbers of people are driven out of the countryside into these disgusting urban slums. Why do you have the crack epidemic in the early 80s? It's, you know, partly industry just abandons American cities. You have mass closure of factories. Why do you have the meth crisis in rural America just after the massive defunding of rural America and it's handed over to you know, big pharma with an F? You know, it's when people are stripped of their sources of meaning. It's not a coincidence that since the 2008 crash, you've seen this huge spike. The middle class is collapsing. People are in terrible distress. And so I think you can deal with the immediate problem through prescription, support, love, but we have to deal with the deeper underlying reasons. Why do so many of our fellow citizens in Britain and America not want to be present in their lives? I've seen this in my own family. Why are they in such pain? You know, if you give people no meaning, if you give them terrible jobs that are boring, repetitive, and chronically insecure, if you, you know, make it very hard for them to connect with the people around them, they're going to not want to be present in their lives. And I'm conscious that I'm sounding like this is quite a depressing book. Actually, I was worried that it would be depressing. I feel incredibly optimistic. I've seen the future and it works. You know, I went to the countries where you can take all these tragedies. You know, I got quite emotional in Portugal because, if I'm completely honest, I put off going to Portugal for a while because I thought, oh, Jesus, what if I go to Portugal and Switzerland? And they're also a disaster, then I'm just going to be describing an irrevocable human tragedy. Mm. To go to those places and see these people and meet people who've been so sunk in addiction and so lost, and these policies were introduced and it just turned around. Actually, you mentioned earlier the story in Vancouver. I don't know if we're running out of time, I guess we are, but the story of a homeless street addict I got to know in Vancouver who started an uprising and transformed his country is one of the most moving things I've ever seen. Bud Osborne in the year 2000 was a homeless street addict in the downtown east side of Vancouver, one of the worst concentrations of addicts in North America, you know, the worst, in fact, and was watching his friends die all around him. And he thought, I've got to do something, but what can I do? I'm just a homeless junkie. And he noticed that a lot of his friends, what would happen is they would use behind dumpsters so the police wouldn't see them. But obviously, if you use behind a dumpster, no one else sees you if you're overdosing. And he just started something really simple. He just said, why don't we get together as addicts and we'll patrol the alleyways. And when we spot one of his overdosing, we'll call an ambulance. And he did it, and they did it for 6 months, and the overdose rate really fell. And that was great in itself, but they started to think differently about themselves. They're like, oh, maybe we're not just the pieces of crap everyone's been saying we are. And they formed a group, and they started, amongst other things, stalking the mayor of Vancouver, Philip Owen, who was a kind of right-wing, rich businessman, very much like Mitt Romney. And they stalked him for 2 years. They found out that in Germany they'd opened safe injecting rooms and it had brought the overdose rate massively down. So they started stalking him everywhere with a coffin that said, when will you open a safe injecting room, Philip Owen? When will you save our lives? And this goes on for 2 years and they get a bit disheartened because they think nothing's happening. And one day, Philip Owen, to his eternal credit, says, who the hell are these people? And he goes to meet a load of them and he goes and spends a load of time on the downtown east side. And Philip Owen holds a press conference, then goes to meet Milton Friedman, the Nobel Prize winning economist, who was very good on this issue. And he comes back and he holds a press conference, and he has the coroner, the chief of police, and an addict. And he says, we're going to open the first injecting room in North America. We're going to have the most compassionate drug policies in North America. And they open it. And Philip Owen was deselected by his own Conservative Party. They were so horrified by what he'd done. And he was eventually, so they select a right-wing candidate. He was then beaten by a Liberal candidate who wanted to keep the injecting room open and did. And, you know, it's now, you know, more than 10 years later, and the results are in, and it was kind of mind-blowing. The average life expectancy in the downtown east side of Vancouver has improved by 10 years, and overdose is down by 80%. And Philip Owen, when I met him, told me it was the proudest thing he ever did, and he would sacrifice his political career all over again. And last year when Bud died, they sealed off the streets of the downtown east side where he had lived homeless for so long. And, you know, huge numbers of people in that crowd knew they were alive because of what Bud had started. And what I would say to anyone listening to this who feels like, about the war on drugs or indeed anything, you know, oh, this is such a struggle, it's so difficult, I would say you are so much more powerful than you know. You know, Bud, it's hard to think of a more disempowered person than a homeless street addict.
Right.
And Bud started something that transformed his country. You know, Billie Holiday never stopped singing her song. And all over the world, while we speak, people are listening to Billie Holiday's songs and they are feeling stronger. You are so much more powerful than you know. And we can do so much. We can, for a start, we can end this global war. We gave it 100 years. It's been a disaster. We can change this and we can choose a policy that's based on compassion and love and genuinely helping people.
Johann Hari, the book is Chasing the Scream, The First and Last Days of the War on Drugs. I can't recommend the book highly enough. We'll have a link to it, obviously, at majority.fm. And people should also check out the site for the book, Chasing the Scream. I was on there last night taking the quiz. I got to say, 8 out of 10. I did pretty well.
It's chasingthescream.com, we should say.
Chasingthescream.com. Johann, thanks so much for coming on.
Really appreciate it. What a pleasure to be with you again, Sam. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Bye-bye.